I have to feed my family, but the family and the mosquitoes are the same thing. 1 inch having fed so many mosquitoes, the hero was taken ill and the play went on, describing his sufferings and the sufferings of his family brought about by his inability to work. Just when their food supply was running out, rats put in an appearance in their house. The part of rats was played by Tibetan children who wore masks and neatly carried their long tails under their arms. The hero said, footnote, eat, little rats, eat, 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 feed your little bodies, gray brothers. Eat, gray brothers, eat, eat, eat. Our food is yours, gray brothers. Eat, little rats, eat, eat, eat. I quote these passages from memory, but should like to add that the text of the dialogues and monologues was much longer, and much more elaborate. The rats ate the food of the semi-starved family and became more and more numerous. A scene came in now in which the hero exalted the happiness of giving away everything. If the rats eat the first half of my meal, I give them the second half, he exclaimed, in what a heretical spectator might have called a fit of religious hysteria. He did not seem to consider what his own children thought of it, but this seemed to be of less importance to him than the well-being of the rats. All the above had lasted more than 2 hours, but the play went on uninterruptedly, the Tibetan crowds following it with breathless suspense. Some people had their mouths wide open, while others shed tears, and not a whisper could be heard. In the following scene the rats had become fourfold in number. All the food was eaten. The hero and his children were seated in the center and a few dozen rats walked round them in circles which were becoming smaller and smaller. Kaya, Kaya. Footnote. We are hungry. Round, round, round. There is nothing to eat. Kaya, 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 came the chorus of the rats. The hero started a long monologue full of pity for the rats. The religious gentleman seemed to have forgotten all about the hunger of his own children. Suddenly the rats seized one of the children and carried the little one outside in order to devour it. The hero was unperturbed. He started a lofty monologue about the joy of sacrificing one's own children and the glory of union of all creatures. At that moment a Tibetan youngster stifled a laugh. The public was aghast and there were loud shouts of protest. The sinner was instantly escorted footnote. Round, round. Out by a few lamas and the play went on. It was some time before a few old ladies had got over their indignation. Dalma told me in whispers that she could not remember having seen a play where the religious tendency had been so apparent as in the present one. The amusement of the Tibetan youngster had greatly upset the lamas. Dalma said that it was probable they would quickly cancel a few of the remaining scenes which were most religious, as the play seemed to be too strong for the younger generation. Have you ever seen so highly religious a play? She asked in a low voice. No, I said. I am sure I told the truth when I said that. The monologue of the hero, which had been interrupted by the outbreak of the youngster, continued interminably. He envied his child, he declared, because it had for a short while at least made its escape from this world of suffering. He seemed to imply that death was a very cheerful and enviable process. After finishing his monologue, the hero was distinctly pleased. So were the rats. And the religious play went on. As I learned later, it was somewhat in the nature of an experiment, and the lamas had actually got together to cancel a few scenes to prevent a recurrence of the irreverent incident and the dreadful calamity of another stifled laugh. I knew that the lamas seldom failed to introduce themselves and a certain number of demons into religious plays performed in Tibetan monasteries. I was waiting anxiously for their appearance, as the endless monologues and dialogues had become rather tedious. Finally a lama appeared in the show. He had obviously been chosen and dressed in a way calculated to show the Tibetan priesthood in the best possible light. Moreover, everything the lama said in the play seemed to be intended to strengthen the authority of the priests. The lama did not give many explanations to the devout and respectful hero, but insisted on blind belief. The latter repeated on several occasions, I believe you, O lama. Yes, I believe you. Yes, 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 I believe you. I do not disbelieve you, O lama. No, I do not disbelieve you. No, 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 I do not disbelieve you. The hero explained to the Lama that he had sacrificed everything in order to attain the joys of Nirvana. He enumerated his merits in a fashion none too modest. He had even given his own children to feed those poor darling rats. But he was worried about the sins he had committed before embarking on his virtuous existence. That was why he requested the spiritual assistance and advice of the Holy Lama, who deigned to meet him in a lofty spirit of sacrifice and pity for this sinful world which was so greatly in need of lamas to fight evil and to take a stand for, encouragement to be good, admonition to avoid evil, advice to clean the heart. Such as is the law of the Buddhist. If my memory serves me correctly, the last two verses were even textually borrowed from Sanskrit and pronounced by the actor in that language with a strong Tibetan accent. Sachitaparya Dapanam, etam buddhsnasa sanam. The following is a synopsis of the subsequent conversation between the sinner and the Lama, freely translated from the lofty and complicated language used by the Tibetan actors into simple and intelligible English. Sinner, I am glad you are here to advise me. Lama, what can I do for you? Sinner, I have sinned very badly in earlier life. Lama, it does not matter. I am glad you sinned then. Sinner, what one you, a holy man, are glad that I sinned. Lama, yes, I am glad you sinned, because there is more joy for 3 sinners who repent than for 300 people who need not repent because they have never sinned. I could not help thinking that under such conditions it is really a fine thing to sin, because there is more joy about sinners who repent than about the permanently virtuous one. Finally, demons began to put in an appearance in the show. It seemed to be interminable. By now we had been seated at least 4 hours and the performance still went on. O Lama, give me religion. Give me religion, O Lama, exclaimed the sinner pathetically again and again. In the following scene a few demons appeared in the background. This did not seem to hasten developments in any way. The plot of the play seemed exceedingly slight. I looked at Dolma. She appeared rather bored and did not attempt to hide the fact. Shall we go? I whispered. It is a little kawa footnote. To get away without attracting attention, she answered. And then, my mother and the other members of my party are scattered all over the audience. We need not walk out together, I suggested. Well, said the girl, I shall walk out first and wait for you just beyond the western gate of the monastery. I am going at once. So at the western gate of the monastery. She repeated it with great care and left immediately, stooping a little and taking a zigzag course across the crowd. A few minutes later I followed her. There is no country in the world where people are more interested in religious matters than they are in Tibet. Religion plays a very important part in everyday conversation. Although few people are interested in really deep religious problems, talks of sorcery, divination, and alleged miracles being much footnote. Difficult. More frequent than theological discussions. However, Dolma seemed to have a bent for the latter. She asked me whether I considered the attitude of the hero in the play a proper one for a really religious person. No, I answered. Shall man be selfish, then? She asked. Is it wrong to try to be good? No, but it is wrong to try to be like God. But God is good. Trying to be like God leads to goodness. The creature must not overstep its limits, I said, by trying to be like God. If he does so, he acts like the angels who revolted against the Creator. There are 2 different types of impersonality, namely, being and beingness. Footnote. The former is an attribute of the creature, the latter an attribute of the Creator. Beingness is absolute impersonality where all division between the I and the non-I ceases. It is beyond the reach of the creature. What happens to a man who wants to attain this state? Asked Dolma. He commits the greatest and most deadly sin against the Creator. She looked greatly perturbed and changed the topic. Are you leaving today, Chedi? She asked. Yes, Dolma, I answered. Are you? We shall ride back in the direction of Tarat Shan. What a pity that you cannot come along. Footnote. Sat in Sanskrit. This subtle difference cannot be expressed in any Western language. But Tarakshan is almost the same direction which I intended to take, Dolma. She did not make any attempt to hide her joy. Splendid 1 inch, she exclaimed. Yo, you may follow us on horseback, and we can meet every day in the evening when the members of my party have retired. But we have good horses and ride about 30 miles a day. Footnote. That is a very good plan, I said. What does your horse look like? She gave an accurate description of it. Then she asked, and yours? You never mentioned it. I do not need a horse, Dolma, I said. She thought I had made a joke. I am quite serious, I added. I can walk at least 30 miles a day. So can I, she said, but only a day or two. You can't walk 120 miles in 4 days. I can, I said, and she believed me. I then briefly explained that I did without a horse to keep in form in order to be able to traverse territories where horses cannot be used. It was arranged that I should leave the district before Dolma. She and her party would leave 2 hours later and overtake me about noon the following day. I already mentioned earlier in the book that vision in most parts of Tibet is excellent. We also devised a very simple and efficient method of marking the places we were passing. I should footnote. In most parts of Tibet this is an exceptionally good daily average to cover on horseback. There are practically no roads and the ground is often sandy. Have no difficulty in finding the place where they would put up their tents. An hour or two after nightfall I was to howl twice like a wolf. Dolma would then leave her tent and join me for some time. Are you certain that they will let you get away alone so late? I asked. Yes, she answered. I am very resourceful. By the way, I inhabit one half of the tent of my mother separated by a partition from the other half. No one is permitted to enter my room under any circumstances unless I call. Even my mother does not do it. So I shall crawl out and try to get past the man keeping watch. Should he see me, I shall tip him to keep his mouth shut. She also promised to write out a letter of introduction addressed to Narbu and to hand it to me in the evening together with an exact description of the place where his dzong was located. Andy, now I must meet my party again, she said, when we returned to the gate of the monastery. The show is nearly over. I walked about alone in order to think. How crowded those 2 days had been, one the demons taking possession of the body of the Sangmai, my meeting a beautiful and clever Tibetan girl who was about to introduce me to a powerful man belonging to an influential secret society, a genuine theatrical performance in a Tibetan monastery in all probability never before visited by any white person, all this I had observed and experienced within a period of less than 2 days. One, I then collected my food supply and started in the direction indicated by beautiful little Dolma. Chapter in charming members of an occult fraternity. Dolma and her party on horseback overtook me early in the afternoon. By the little signs imperceptibly dropped by Dolma every few hundred yards at regular intervals, I could easily find the place where the party had put up their tents. I waited until about 2 hours after nightfall and then howled twice like a wolf. Dolma heard the signal and a quarter of an hour later she had joined me in the darkness. Has someone seen you leave? I asked. Yes, she answered. I could not get away without being noticed by the night watchman who has to be on the lookout for brigands. But I promised him a bag of barley meal if he will keep his mouth shut. As soon as I had done this I ran away as fast as Pal Dorji to come here, she added. Who is Pal Dorji? I asked. What, she exclaimed, you do not know who Pal Dorji was? No, I said. Dolma looked at me in a strange way. As I learnt later, there is hardly a Tibetan, including the less educated ones, who has never heard the story of Pal Dorji, a Tibetan who committed a pious 7-footnote murder at the epoch corresponding to our Middle Ages. Pal Dorji was a clever and resourceful fellow. When he was wanted and his pursuers hounded him to a Tibetan village, he quickly stole a horse, blackened it with soot, and galloped away, his pursuers following him on other horses. When he arrived at a river, Pal Dorji swam across, But while his horse crossed the river, the soot was washed away and the animal had turned white by the time they arrived on the opposite bank. One, when the pursuers arrived at the river, they saw a man gallop away on the other side on a white horse. So these medieval cops thought that Paldorgi had disappeared, and returned home. Dolma had brought a lot of food from her tent. Surely women are alike everywhere. They never lose sight of the physical well-being of someone in whom they are interested. She opened her food parcel, and when I refused to take meat, our conversation at once turned to vegetarianism. "Why do you dislike Spurfootnote?" she asked. "I do not dislike it," I answered. "Then why don't you eat it?" "Because I find it coarse to eat meat. If I eat a piece of meat, I feel like someone who would bite into his left arm to eat it." "There are some people who never eat meat," said Dolma, "but I do not like them. They seem to be afraid of eating meat." Here again, you see, Dolma, that it is really footnote. Meat. More important why we do things than what we are doing. We chatted for half an hour and then Dolma returned to her girl footnote. "I spent the night in my tent and started half an hour before sunrise. The party again overtook me later on in the day at a distance of about half a mile. I slightly modified my direction and followed the little signs dropped regularly by the Tibetan girl. We met again long after sunset in the same manner as the day before. Dolma told me that the watchdog had come to collect his tip in the morning, and when he had got it he had gone to her mother, telling her all he knew about her absence the preceding night, thus securing a second tip. Her mother had been angry and she had told a lie about a solitary walk she had taken during the night. However, this evening she had escaped entirely unnoticed by another Tibetan who had kept watch during the night. Narabu, my teacher, has always told me that a spiritual person should never tell a lie," she said. "I feel guilty, but fail to see how human society can be kept going without lies. There are people who say things which are untrue," one observed, "but it is infinitely worse if someone misrepresents facts and creates a wrong impression without telling a real and formal lie. Such a thing is devilish and greatly offends the Creator much more in fact than an outright lie." "I think you are right," observed Dolma. "I know a story about an occurrence in a monastery which shows how a man can lie against the spirit without telling a real and formal lie. A Tibetan went to confess his sins to a lama whom he knew very well. Just before he entered the monastery, he found a valuable object which he knew was the private property of the lama to whom he was going to confess his sins. He showed it to the priest, but the latter was absent-minded and without looking at it said, 'I do not want it.' Then confession started. The Tibetan asked what he should do if he found a valuable object lying on the ground. 'You must hand it to the rightful owner/' said the lama, "and if he cannot be found immediately, to the monastery." "And if the rightful owner does not want it?" asked the Tibetan. "Then you may keep it," said the lama. The Tibetan left the monastery and kept the valuable object. He knew he had not sinned and had not told a single lie. We both laughed heartily. "Although this lie was no formal lie at all, I much prefer your innocent lying, Dolma," I observed. "Is it not a fact that the more man penetrates into the realm of spirituality, the more he is apartment to lose himself in a tangle of things where words and formal standards of value cease to be a reliable basis, and where everything may be conveniently used as an excuse?" The following evening Dolma and I met for the last time. The day afterwards her party had reached their village. It was not until the parting hour that I fully realized how greatly this beautiful Tibetan girl was devoted to me. She herself may have thought that it was a kind of soul love, but perhaps she was deceiving herself. It was, no doubt, soul love, but soul love with a very pronounced human touch. No matter how much human relationships are on so-called higher levels, there is always a personal touch in them. It may be latent, but is nevertheless very real. There are, no doubt, spiritual people among my readers who profoundly disagree with me in this connection and who stick to the opinion that spiritual contacts must be free from any lower human element. To these readers I should recommend to put to themselves the question whether it would not have mattered at all if Dolma had been a woman of, say, 70 years of age, There are some women of that age who are still very spiritual and vital, or if Dolma, the beautiful young girl, had met me in the visible form of a very spiritual and vital old man of the apparent age of 80. The next few days were somewhat uneventful until I reached the Tibetan Tsong footnote, in which Narbu, Dolma's spiritual teacher, lived. I looked forward to my interview with him. After all that Dolma had told me about him, he appeared not only a highly spiritual person, but also someone entrusted with an important political mission by the occult brotherhood to which he belonged. During the next few days I suffered greatly from lack of water for drinking and washing. There had been no rainfall for many days and everything footnote. Large baos built for powerful people in the district had dried up rapidly. However, an individual accustomed to travel alone in the various deserts of the world easily adapts himself to difficult situations. Even half a pint of water can last over long distances if you merely use it for wetting your parched lips and then put about a cubic inch of water into your mouth, swallowing it very slowly, almost drop by drop. In this way, half a pint of water may keep one going for 2 days. The last afternoon before I reached Narbu's Tsong there was a violent thunderstorm. Something like 2 inches of rain fell in half an hour. Just before the thunderstorm set in, the sky looked indescribably majestic. It was a sight such as can be seen only once in many years in Western countries. The clouds were almost as black as ink and looked as if demons of gigantic proportions were brewing something in a cauldron. Some of the clouds resembled gigantic monsters, and when the torrential downpour started, sheets of lightning followed one another at the rate of about 3 sheets per second. Narbu's Tsong footnote was situated in a comparatively densely inhabited area. I usually avoided the trade routes while I traveled in disguise in Tibet and gave an especially wide berth to places where I had reason to believe that white people had put in an appearance. If my information was correct, the various district governors in Tibet were by then for the most part connected by telephone lines. Footnote. The Tibetan word Tsong has a double meaning. It means fortress or seat of a district governor. But it also means a private residence inhabited by rich people. Which, by the way, seems to indicate that the Tibetans do pin a little more faith on those newfangled things imported for long-distance communication from the West than on their sorcerers, who are supposed to be able to send messages on the wind as the Tibetans put it, that is to say, by telepathy. To have been found at a place serving as a residence to a Tsongkhapa footnote would have been a terrific experience in the Forbidden Country, and it was highly probable that the place in which Narbu resided had been chosen as a place of residence by such an individual. To minimize the risk of detection, I spent the last night a long distance away from the place and then walked 10 miles non-stop early in the morning, intending to arrive at Narbu's residence about an hour and a half after sunrise. Even then I narrowly escaped trouble. When the first houses came in view I sat down for a little while in order to take a few minutes rest before approaching the residence. While I sat there a Tibetan left one of the houses and came up to the place where I was seated on the ground. He eyed me suspiciously as if he had been the Tibetan equivalent of a plainclothes man and then asked in a none too friendly way, "Shilai Iruda / Jinash Runt Dadai?" I answered in as natural a way as possible, a slight touch in my voice denoting a mild degree of annoyance at being disturbed. Footnote. District Governor. F. What are you doing here? Dollar. I sit here to watch. There was nothing particular to be watched. The man once more eyed me suspiciously and went away. But when I arrived at Narbu's house a few minutes later I noticed that he had shadowed me. Police methods are frightfully primitive in Tibet. When he saw that I handed a letter to a servant of so respectable and powerful a man he seemed to be reassured and walked away. The glamour footnote. Looked at my cheap chupa / in an untoo respectful way. The humbler the position of a man in life the more he is inclined to value a man by such futilities as dress and similar trifles, and Tibet does not seem to be different from the West in this respect. He told me that he would hand the letter to His Excellency, but when I said I had to wait for an answer he turned a deaf ear to my request and went away. I waited patiently for half an hour, a wait which was not very pleasant, since some of the passers-by seemed to eye me rather curiously while I stood there in my poor clothes before the main entrance of the rich man's disong. Suddenly a man of about 50 years of age, dressed in pure silk, came out of the house. He at once apologized in a very courteous and apparently sincere manner for having kept me waiting. Dolmer's letter, he explained, had only been handed to him a few minutes before, and he had severely reprimanded the servant for having taken things so leisurely. The Tibetan excellency, who seemed to be a perfect gentleman, then led me upstairs, footnote, servant, gown, to the amazement of the servant who had taken my letter. The floors were covered with costly gants, footnote, and everything in the house seemed to be well appointed and very clean. Dolma has written a very long jige, why, said Narabu, while we walked together to the room where breakfast was served. She is a clever girl and seldom makes a mistake in judging people. She writes that you seem to be a man who possesses a very independent outlook on spiritual matters and is a determined truth seeker. One always liked such people. Dolma also writes that you have traveled very much and that she has some difficulty to believe that you are Tibetan or Ladakhi at all. Would you not make a clean breast of it? Neither Dolma nor I ever betray anyone. You have my word of honor that nothing whatsoever which you may entrust to me will ever leak out. I looked at him and was more and more impressed by his unostentatious attitude and sincere manner. A servant entered the room, bringing various kinds of food. It was the first time during my travels in Tibet that I had something almost amounting to what may be called an opulent breakfast. I even got spokri from India and other things which are considered great delicacies by the Tibetans. The servant left the room, and Narabu once more told me that it would be better for all concerned if I did not hide from him anything. I shall tell you the truth, I said, but your footnote, carpets. F letter. Excellency will be greatly and perhaps unpleasantly surprised. Drop the excellency, he said smilingly. Dolma's friends are my own, and spiritual ties remove all considerations of rank. Let us be friends. The servant returned with more food. As soon as he opened the door, we began to talk about meaningless things, Narabu asking whether I had heard any interesting things on my travels. I answered that I had seen and heard very much during the last few weeks. Suddenly the servant almost opened his mouth with amazement. What was the matter? I realized that I had committed the dreadful crime of using the words mthnanthos footnote. In answering his excellency, instead of employing the more polite and ceremonial words gx and gshan / which mean exactly the same thing. The servant looked greatly puzzled. Narabu asked him whether he had something else to attend to in the room, and when the glammy / answered in the negative, Narabu ordered him to put tea and teacups in the study and then to join the asana / and not to return before the time had come for the next meal. We went to Narabu's study, and when we had sat down I broke the news to him that I was a Westerner traveling in disguise. I had my suspicions the moment I saw you, he replied smilingly. But you played your part, footnote. Seen and heard. F servant. Percent the chief cook of his household. Remarkably well. Unless people's attention is specially drawn to you, I doubt whether even educated Tibetans would find you out. I have decided to turn deaf and dumb every time I meet lamas or educated people, I told him. That is a very wise course to take, he observed. Do not feel uncomfortable because I told you that I had felt the un-Tibetan atmosphere about you. I have traveled extensively, both on private business and on behalf of my friends in the valley. I have been to India, China, Japan, and Pilinpa. We may speak English if you like. The lengthy conversations which followed were in English until we took our next meal, during which we were attended by two servants. Narabu had a fairly good knowledge of English. Our talk drifted to the subject of politics and the various great powers. Narabu seemed to have excellent, although in some respects a little stale, information about the currents underlying the various visible political trends of our time. We soon felt that our conversation was of the greatest mutual benefit. He once more assured me that neither he nor Dolma would ever betray me and that I should communicate with him immediately in case I got into trouble. My arms are very long in this country, he added smilingly. Again he casually mentioned the valley. While we talked about other matters, he again and again mentioned a valley in Tibet where many highly evolved spiritual people lived with whom he was in close contact. When he mentioned it for the fourth time, I took this for an invitation to ask him something about it.